If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm fresh taste of Eggland's Best Eggs. Only Eggland's Best hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. The Japanese city of Nagasaki is probably best known for being the target of the world's second ever nuclear attack in August 1945. But far fewer people will know that the city was also home to hundreds of Allied prisoners of war, forcibly put to work to support the Japanese war economy. John Willis's book Nagasaki delves into the incredible and largely forgotten story of the POWs who survived the brutal camps in the Far East. He told Spencer Mizzen more about how they were transported to the Japanese mainland on so-called hell ships, and later witnessed a bomb that would help bring the Second World War to an end.
Now, John, as the title of your book acknowledges, this really is a forgotten story, isn't it? Very few people, it seems to me, are aware that there were Allied POWs incarcerated on the Japanese mainland, let alone in Nagasaki. So how did you come across this story?
I was completely flabbergasted. I knew quite a lot about Japan. I'd spent some time there. I'd been to Hiroshima, but I had absolutely no idea at all that there were Allied prisoners of war until many years ago, I met one of them. I met a man called Ron Breyer, a Yorkshireman from near Harrogate, who survived the second atomic weapon, the most powerful bomb ever dropped by man. And I couldn't resist telling his story, which I did for a TV program. And then recently, I thought, you know, this would make a book. We need to know more. I've got his story, but there were so many others there that I wanted to write a rounded, complete picture of what it was like on the ground when the bomb dropped.
How did you go about researching the book? And what sources did you use? I mean, would I be right in saying it was a mixture of interviews, of talking to survivors' families, of diaries as well?
It was a mixture of things. There's, inevitably, there's not much written down about this. It's probably why the story's been invisible for so many decades, because it was very dangerous to keep a diary or to keep notes. You'd get beaten up or sometimes even worse. So there are examples. For example, one prisoner wrote his diary in Irish, an Irish prisoner, so that if they were, no one would understand them. Others, knowing they were dangerous, buried diaries in graves of other prisoners, and then after the war, they were then collected again. So it was a dangerous process. So I managed to get hold of these diaries. There have been in recent years quite an outpouring, I think, as the survivors get older or start to die off, that their children have been wanting to tell this story. So on the internet, there's unpublished or self-published little memoirs or pamphlets. And then I had quite a lot of material from my television documentary I made several years ago that hadn't seen the light of day, interviews with quite a lot of prisoners, notes that they'd made. So I had a mixture of different sources.
Could you tell us a little bit more about Ron Breyer himself? I mean, how did he react to sort of trawling over all these old memories when you were going through them all those years ago?
Well, I think Ron was an extraordinary character. He was hardwired in many ways to survive. He was one of 10 children, brought up in rural poverty outside Harrogate. So he was used to poaching and having sharp elbows to make sure he had enough to eat. And yet he was super intelligent, very intelligent. So he went to the local grammar school and was selected by the RAF for special training. So he had lots of the qualities that you needed to survive. And he was an engineer, which is very useful in terms of making things and making and mending when you're in a prison of war camp. And I think he kept it all very buried. Some of the prisoners, a lot of them had nightmares and had a pretty terrible time when they came home. Ron just shut it all down. And then I went back to Nagasaki with him. And I think it just all came flooding back. He stood on the balcony of his hotel at 4 a.m, looked down on a city that's now bustling and busy and rebuilt, but had just been wiped from the face of the earth before. And I think he thought about all the people he knew who died in Japanese hands, and all the emotion came flooding out. And he said, I didn't think that would ever happen to me again. I never thought that would happen, but it did.
And had he told his family much about his experiences? What was their reaction?
I think he had told his family about his experiences bit by bit. And it's quite a lot of prisoners who survived the Nagasaki bomb didn't say much to their family, or only said it really late in life when the kids were grown up and were adult, when perhaps they'd reached retirement age themselves, and they were starting to kind of piece together the jigsaw puzzle of their experiences. And this was such a profound experience to have. So I think that he had told them a fair amount, but it was really only when he was in my television documentary that they started to see the fuller picture.
So one of the first questions that pops into my head when I saw your book is, what were all these Allied POWs doing in the Nagasaki area at the climax of the Second World War? So, I mean, yeah, why had they been taken there?
Well, as the war went on, the Japanese became short of manpower or person power in their factories. Their men were all away fighting the war or had been killed or imprisoned. And so they had on tap a ready-made but also dispensable workforce in terms of Allied prisoners of war. So thousands of them were shipped to Japan. And those in Nagasaki was a key military-industrial complex. It was run largely by Mitsubishi, and who made torpedoes, aeroplanes, ships. So they worked a lot of them worked in the shipyards. So Ron Breyer, for example, worked in the shipyards as a riveter. He'd had no training and just picked it up in a couple of days. It was quite a heavy-duty job. Others worked in foundries making weapons. So basically, it was their job to support the Japanese military effort. Although, if they could, they would find little minor acts of sabotage just to slow things down.
Right. Can you give us a couple of examples of those, please?
Yes. For example, in the shipyards, there were obviously guards and military police watching them, so it was quite a tricky thing to, but they would drop rivets into the water or not put the rivets in properly, that sort of thing, just small things. But if several people did it, and even if it didn't really work, it made them feel better. It made them feel that they were fighting the war. It made people feel they weren't passive but active.
Now, John, just rewind a little bit. Your book doesn't just chronicle the POW's experiences in Nagasaki. It also tells the story of their capture by Japanese forces, their experiences in camps all over the Far East. And so that includes the horrors of those camps or working on the River Kwai Railway. Why did you decide to adopt that approach to kind of look at the bigger picture instead of just focusing on Nagasaki?
A couple of reasons. One was that Nagasaki was just the climax of their terrible years of endurance. So it wasn't just, if you saw it just as one event, you wouldn't understand that for 2.5-3 years before, they'd been malnourished, they'd been ill, they'd been beaten and badly treated while working in appalling conditions, as you say, on the River Kwai Railway or elsewhere. So I felt that it gave a context so you understood much more how they'd got there and how they'd survived that far.
Now on that, you relate some pretty grim episodes from the Allied collapse in the Far East. And just to cite one example, there's an Australian soldier called Fred Airy who, having survived a firing squad, was forced to play dead in a creek in Singapore while Japanese troops moved around shooting wounded POWs. You've also got example of nurses being forced to walk into the sea before being shot. I mean, did you get a sense in your research of just how shocked and discombobulated not just Allied troops but also Allied commanders were by what was happening on the ground at the time?
Well, I think that the Allies probably had an expectation that the Geneva Convention on Prisoners of War, conventions on prisoners of war, would be upheld. The Japanese had approved it but never signed it. So I think that they expected more civilized treatment than they actually got. On the other hand, we know that the Japanese in China had already committed some pretty horrific offenses. So the cultural differences, I think, between the two, the Allies and the Japanese, was huge. Language, culture, history, I think it was really difficult for either side to understand each other. And I think, too, probably in the early days of capture, the rules were all fuzzy. In places like Java, it was a long way from Tokyo where the rules about prisoners of war were being written. So the commander on the ground, who might not be at the top level in his profession, otherwise he'd be fighting, not guarding, had quite a lot of room for manoeuvre. And some behaved okay, and some behaved absolutely appallingly and committed the terrible acts of brutality.
Sean, I wonder if you could introduce us to some of the other main characters and POWs in your book. Could we talk about Aidan McCarthy? Because he was, am I right in saying, an RAF doctor, and it sounds like he'd had some pretty extraordinary experiences in the war even before he got to the Far East. Is that correct?
Correct. I think Aidan was another good example, and I was lucky enough to spend some time with his two daughters, and he came from Ireland, but he joined up the RAF, was a doctor in the RAF, and even before captivity, he'd won a medal for rescuing with another person. A Wellington bomber crashed at his RAF base at Honington on the kind of Suffolk-Norfolk border, and he, as a doctor, and one of the other servicemen just rushed in despite the flames, despite the fact that there was a risk of explosion, and pulled them free. So he was a pretty brave person by any standards. He was also at Dunkirk. So he had already lived through some pretty perilous moments before he got to the Far East. But he was in an unusual position because as a doctor, you weren't working in the shipyards necessarily or always in the front line. You were operating basically with a razor blade and a couple of handmade tools and no medicines. You were trying to save people's lives. So his life was different. But towards the end, he was the senior officer in the camp in Nagasaki. And I remember his daughters telling me that if one of his men broke a rule, they were beaten. And he, as the senior officer, would get beaten as well. So he was beaten pretty regularly while in Nagasaki.
And also wanted to mention somebody called Alan Chick. Now, I've got a copy of the book in front of me, and I believe he's a person on the left-hand side of the cover. And he looks impossibly young from that picture. What are his experiences while in Nagasaki?
The Australians, it's really interesting that this book, which doesn't come out in Australia yet, but is already being talked about. I had a message from someone the other day. They've just bought 15 copies of the book because what they've said is that it tells us, I knew about my dad, but this tells the complete picture. Now I see it in the round, and I see that he wasn't the only one. And the British, I think, were still quite hierarchical in terms of officers and other ranks. The Australians, I think, was much flatter. The officers, some were good, some were not so good, but they were much closer to the men. And the Australians are great, believe in mateship, comradeship, friendship, and they stuck together, I think, in a little group. Alan Schick was a Tasmanian. As you say, he looks very young in that picture, fabulous slouch, Aussie bush hat, and a slight lack of teeth. He looks great. And he survived. He was pretty lucky. The bomb went off. He was on a building, which was unusual. Most of them were inside the buildings where it was, and he was blown off the building, but survived. He went out of the camp. The camp had been completely destroyed. There was nothing left. And quite nearby was a camp where Chinese workers lived. And he found most of those dead. But Alan then, with a group of other Australians, found a horse and cart. And it was seemed very strange to me that people are dead, people are wounded, burnt, blistered. There's no buildings apart from a few skeletal structures. And there's a horse and cart waiting like a taxi on a rank for them. And Alan and one of the others, Eric Hooper, were both country boys, so they knew how to deal with a horse. So they put the Australian injured, on the back of the horse, and they disappeared off to the edge of town and then walked up to the mountains. And what was interesting about Alan is that at the end of the war, he went back. He's the only one, more or less, well, there must be more, but about the only one I found, who went back to Japan as part of the Allied occupying forces. So he stayed in the conflict. He didn't say, this is enough, I've seen a bomb. He went back. He married a Japanese woman. They went back to live in Australia, were very happy. And Alan reached the grand old age of 93.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Ron Brower, the Yorkshireman, was nearly killed by a pallet of American chewing gum. And he said, I don't think it was written that I would escape the atomic weapon only to be killed by a pallet of chewing gum.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Did you get a sense that that sense of mateship that those Australian troops have, did that help them, you know, survive these extraordinary, terrible experiences?
I think that obviously mateship is an Australian concept, but the British or the Dutch or the Americans also had groups of friends. And I'm sure that having a friend was absolutely critical in this, that if there was two of you, if one was ill, then the other could help them through over that crisis, and the other way round. If one is trying to steal some food from the Japanese cookhouse, the other can be on the lookout. So there was mutual support, and I think it was really, really important. But it was particularly powerful, I think, with the Australians.
Now, one of the most vivid sections of the book is your description of the so-called hell ships, which took Allied POWs to mainland Japan. I mean, you relate the anecdote of one Japanese vessel, the Tamahohu Maru, which was torpedoed by American submarines just outside Nagasaki. Can you elaborate on that little bit more? Tell us what was going on there.
Well, I think that I'd heard, you know, the phrase hell ships, but didn't really know all that much about it. And I think this is one of the most extraordinary moments in the book and in this whole story, because the drama of it and the horror of it are truly incredible. So you imagine these men have survived Java, Singapore, the building the River Kwai Railway, which, you know, was 20% people died. It was pretty horrific conditions. And they think that's the worst they've ever seen. And they're loaded into the holds of these ancient ships, rusty old hulks. And they were so crowded that you couldn't lie down. You had to sit up. And one of them said that when you moved, you all had to move at the same time like jelly. That was the only way that you could move. And they were in little convoys with oil tankers mainly. So I think that they were seen as legitimate targets because oil obviously drove the Japanese military and they were short of oil. So sinking an oil tanker was important. So they were at risk, particularly as the war went on, of a torpedo attack. And that's exactly what happened to the Tamahoko Maru. It was hit by an American torpedo. They were just outside Nagasaki. They were just starting to relax. They were allowed on deck for the first time. They were singing Waltzing Matilda and Vera Lynn songs. And the crew were pleased to be safe and home. And then the torpedo hit. And Aidan McCarthy, who you mentioned before, the Irish doctor, was really lucky. He was in a row of officers, sleeping, and he found a rat in his bed. And so he was fighting the rat off. And so he was awake. And when the torpedo hit, which was around midnight, he was fine. He survived. And all the other officers next to him had all died, were all killed at that moment. He was blown out into the water. And he was a very strong swimmer from having been brought up on the coast of Southern Ireland. And he managed to survive, and they survived basically by hanging on to bits of wood, old rafts, toilets, any bit of debris they could possibly find. They clung on to, and I think 212 of them survived and finished up in a camp in Nagasaki.
Okay, so you've got these prisoners, Allied prisoners in and around Nagasaki at the end of the war. I mean, from your research, did you get any idea of how aware the POWs were of what was happening in the wider world? Were they aware that the tide of war had turned decisively against the Japanese?
I think that one of the things that they didn't have, which is partly why I called the book or subtitle it Forgotten Prisoners, that they didn't really have any idea what was going on. Even on the River Kwai Railway, they had illicit radios, or a few of them, which enabled them to tune into the BBC or elsewhere. In Nagasaki, that was not possible. So they were completely starved of information. They might just get a scrap of newspaper they might find drifting around the dockyard or on their walk to the dockyard in Japanese, and they try to make sense of it. But I think they began to sense that things, they had no idea about VE Day, they didn't know about Hiroshima, but suddenly American planes started flying over the city, and there was a bombing run 8 days before the nuclear bomb was dropped, where Nagasaki was quite badly hit. And I think they realized that at that point the tide had turned, to see the sound of an American bomber over the city was frightening in one way, but of course induced a tremendous amount of hope in another.
And did Allied commanders know that the POWs were there?
I think that it seems impossible to me that they didn't know, for two reasons. One was that there is some intelligence that Japanese prisoners of war said, or 200 pale men seen, white men seen working in dockyard, probably POW. So there's scraps of that. But more important, when some of the hell ships were torpedoed, American submarines were part of the rescue. So they torpedoed, killed several hundred people, and then rescued them. So those men, where were they going? Well, they were going to the Japanese mainland to work in military industries. What cities? Well, Nagasaki would be very high up the list for that. So I think intelligence would have to be pretty dense not to have worked out that Nagasaki was, in all likelihood, a place where there was going to be Allied prisoners of war. And of course, Nagasaki wasn't the target of the bomb originally. So it might be that there was one of the reasons why Nagasaki wasn't higher up the list of targets. It was a secondary target, was that they knew there were Allied prisoners of war. So you can't be 100% sure, but you can be 95% sure.
And what did the POWs say about the moment that the atomic bomb was dropped on Nagasaki? I mean, there must be some pretty vivid descriptions of that moment.
Well, of course, you know, they didn't know what a nuclear weapon was. They hadn't heard about Hiroshima, as I said. So, you know, all of a sudden, Ron Breyer, the Yorkshireman we talked about earlier, was lucky he was mending a bomb shelter. And the bomb shelter just collapsed on top of him. He said it was kind of liquid, light, intense, and then a vibration and a kind of roar. People described as being like a thousand photographers' flares. People described as a marine searchlights. And I think it was quite vivid. And they thought, this is the end of the world. I'm dead. This is it. And when they came to, or they struggled out of the rubble of the buildings they were in, one of them said it was as if Nagasaki had been swept aside by a broom. There was nothing there. All they could see was Ron got up and suddenly saw about 100 Japanese civilians and workers running like crazy animals. Didn't look at him, but they just ran past him, on fire, blistered arms. And he said they were like animals in a hunt, just trying to escape from death. So I think it was immediately very, very vivid. And some of them a little further away saw the mushroom cloud, so saw the angry foam of white and brown and black and yellow in the cloud as well. And again, they thought, what is this? And they had no idea that it was a nuclear weapon.
And what did this event mean to them in the short term? Did it mean instant liberation?
It didn't mean instant liberation. It meant liberation, because they were certain and there's a lot of evidence to support this, both anecdotal and, you know, in the records, that the Japanese fully intended that if there was an Allied invasion of the homeland, of the Japanese homeland, that the prisoners of war would be killed. Pits were being dug, tunnels were being opened up. So they all felt sure that they wanted to be liberated, but they felt if they were liberated, that would probably be the end for them. So there was an immediate sense of relief, and then uncertainty, because after a few hours, more Japanese troops arrived mysteriously from somewhere with some, from somewhere inland, presumably with some rice, and they were sent to another camp on the edge of Nagasaki, so away probably from, you know, radioactive the radioactive materials, but further away, several miles out of Nagasaki. So they were held there until the Japanese surrendered. So the Japanese didn't surrender straight away, but it took them a few days for that to happen. And then they were on their own. They had to work out, well, how do we feed ourselves? How do we guard ourselves? How do we get home? Do we just wait for the Americans? An American food drop started. So for the first time for nearly 4 years, they started having, you know, butter and bacon and biscuits, and huge pallets and oil drums of food were dropped from the sky. And the men just wept tears when they saw all this. They couldn't believe it. But it was quite dangerous. Ron Breyer, the Yorkshireman, was nearly killed by a pallet of American chewing gum. And he said, I don't think it was written that I would escape the atomic weapon only to be killed by a pallet of chewing gum.
That's extraordinary. I mean, they'd been to hell and back. What kind of impact did the terrible things that they'd experienced have on them over the longer term? I mean, was this something that they could ever come to terms with from your experience of doing the interviews and reading their diaries?
I think that some of them did. I mean, some of them, I think, have found ways of coming to terms with it. And those ways might be to embrace normality as much as possible and to try to forget about it. But I would say that the overwhelming evidence is that the vast majority of prisoners of war of the Japanese had nightmares for many, many years afterwards, would have what now would be called post-traumatic stress disorder, that some of them wouldn't have Japanese cars, Japanese TV sets. Some of them found it really difficult in terms of their relationships when they came home, because they went away as, you know, like, you know, bright-eyed 19-year-olds or 20-year-olds and came back at 24 or 25, having endured all this and seen horrors that they would never imagine. How do you talk about it? Do you talk about it? So I think that there was a lot of trauma in relationships. I think some of them found it quite difficult to relate to their children, because the children would say, is that my daddy? That's not what the picture was like. And they'd never seen their children before. So I think that was difficult for people. So I think the scars ran quite deeply. As one of the sons said to me, my dad survived the nuclear weapon in Nagasaki, so he won the war, but he was so unhappy when he got home that he lost the peace. And that's a terrible irony, to survive all this and then only find that for the rest of your life you're unhappy because you're carrying the burden of it all.
And what kind of impact did meeting these men and their families have on you?
That's an interesting question. I think that if, like me, you've, you know, spent a lot of years making television documentaries, occasionally you have an experience. It's very privileged. You enter into other people's lives. They allow you in. And to have an insight into this incredible and, as I say, forgotten and invisible experience in Nagasaki, I found very profound. It really made me think about all the issues. It made me think about the men. I thought they were extraordinary. And it was really only when I was less involved in television and started to write books, this is the third one I've written in the last few years, that I went back to this and realised this was a story that needed amplification and retelling.
That was John Willis. Nagasaki, The Forgotten Prisoners is out now, published by Mensch. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Brittany Colley.